Behold the sword of power, Excalibur.
Welcome to the Oh Gosh, Oh Golly, Oh Wow podcast, the podcast where we talk about the Marvel Comics series Excalibur and nothing but Excalibur every week for 126 plus weeks. This week in episode 42, we're discussing Excalibur 41, at last, the reunion, in which Excalibur finally reunites with the X-Men, kinda, but this issue at least confirms Excalibur and the X-Men do, in fact, have access to phones. Excalibur number 41 was originally published in September 1991, and the creative team is Scott Lobdell and Dana Moorshead on writing, Dave Hoover on pencils, Christopher Ivey and Harry Candelario on inks, Glynis Oliver and Mike Thomas on colors, Bill Oakley on letters, and Terry Cavanaugh on editing.
Your wisdom has forged this ring. Hereafter, so that we remember our bonds, we shall always come together in a circle to hear and tell of deeds good and brave. I will build a round table where this fellowship shall meet. Yeah. And a hall about the table. Yeah. And a castle about the hall. Yeah. And I will marry. Yeah. And the land will have an heir to wield Excalibur. Yeah. Knights of the Round Table.
And we are off on the last Lobdell issue before Alan Davis's triumphant return. I'm in a celebratory mood this week about that. And even better, there are at least a few, maybe possibly interesting things in this issue to talk about, and plenty of stuff not in this issue that I'm sure we'll talk about as well with our fabulous guest, who I will introduce in a moment. But first, your regular souls. I am Dr. Anna Papard. You can find me lots of popular and academic places chatting about gender and sex and superheroes and various devil boys and robots and mutants and aliens. I am also Kurt Wagner's unofficial PR manager, a title I acquired after getting back into X-Men comics a year and change ago, almost 2 years ago now. And the specific thing that got me reading again was a tweet by Andrew from the Claremont Run account about the friendship between Nightcrawler and Wolverine. Aww. It is very sad to me how rarely we have a chance to talk about that friendship on this podcast, but today gives us a little bit of an excuse, a tiny opening to do so, so we will probably do so a little bit. Mav, if you'd like to reintroduce our listeners to your magnificent self.
Are you sure it's me, or am I somebody pretending to be me? Or, you know, how long have you known me? Could you tell if I was? Because that's a question that I have because of this issue.
Yes.
My name's Christopher Maverick, but you can call me Mav. I'm the host of another show called Vox Popcast. I teach literature and composition and cultural studies and philosophy lately, actually, at three different universities in Western Pennsylvania. And I study comics and culture and gender and sex and race and things like that, and pop culture and 20th century. And I'm just happy this is the last Lobdell issue. It will be like saying goodbye to a acquaintance, a friend, something. This is, I don't know how I feel about this. We're going to talk about it. Yeah. Oh yeah. Saying goodbye to a babysitter that you just, you know, you don't love, you don't hate, you know, it's not the worst person that is going to be on this book, but I'm just glad it's over. So that's it for me.
I have a whole podcast still to talk about this one issue. So
yeah.
We'll get to it.
I have mixed feelings.
Yeah. I mean, there's... Anyway, we'll get to it. Andrew, if you'd like to reintroduce our listeners to your fabulousness.
Hello, I'm Dr. Andrew DeMann. I am a lecturer at St. Jerome's University, and I am the project lead for the Claremont Run, which is a cool academic study with a social media component. And according to one angry commenter, it's actually the source of the, quote, ridiculous notion that the X-Men has a queer subtext. So if you've ever appreciated the queer subtext of X-Men, you technically owe me a royalty since I invented that in 2019. Oh, and
we're
you're
not
welcome.
Worthy. We're not worthy.
What do you do except laugh at that? I don't...
Corrupting everyone.
Mm-hmm. On your business cards.
That's true.
My name is Andrew DeMann. I invented gay.
Congratulations, Andrew. The pod is worked up to welcome this week's guest, a woman who goes back a long way with a certain fuzzy elf and his extended family, Sue Wisterfield. Welcome, Sue.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I will tell our listeners a little bit about you. So Sue describes herself as just a fan, white, British working class, and proudly Northern, and infamously a mad cat woman. She introduced us to her cat a little while ago. She's a lifelong SF and fantasy book reader who since the late 70s has had fandom as her social life. She attends conventions, runs conventions, and does fan art for convention publications and fanzines in the UK. She's been an anime fan, a costumer, a filker, a fan artist, a trader in the dealer's room, a medieval reenactor, a tabletop RPG player, and of course, a comics fan. She stood up in front of thousands of fans to be the MC at the Worldcon Masquerade. She's won 2 Hugo Awards for fan art and other fanish art awards. She's been out to dinner with many writers and artists and is eager to chat fandom and fanish loves with us today. So there's so much I'm eager to chat with you about, but let's start a little bit with your comics history. So you've obviously been a fan of these things for a long time, but what's your actual origin story with X-Men comics? When did you first discover them?
I cannot remember the exact date. It has to be around about late 1980 or early 81, because I was at college and I vividly remember walking into the students' union and declaring to my friends that I had a new elf and this one was blue. And then, because I, you know the way some people in fandom like vampires? Well, with me it was elves, you know what I mean? And so having a blue one was nothing, you know, this was just Tuesday. But I'd never stopped reading comics. I'd read comics as a kid, read comics as a teenager, British comics. So it was nothing new. I've had stranger conversations with my friends than that one.
Well, beyond your obvious affection for Nightcrawler, which we will talk about today, what kind of draws you to the world of X-Men comics? What's kept you sort of interacting with this world for all these years?
It's a bit of an anomaly because it's the only superhero comic I really ever read, because most of my comics reading was independence, or I read 2000 AD, I read Warrior, and Warrior was all the crew who came over and was the British invasion, you know, in the 80s, and Alan Moore and all that lot. And so I'd leave the comic shop on a Saturday with a big pile of Omaha the Cat Dancer and Zot and May and Love and Rockets, and tucked somewhere in the middle, almost like a guilty secret, would be a copy of the X-Men.
I love that.
I don't know what it wasn't. I wasn't ashamed of reading it. It's just, it was an aberration. It was not like my other comic book reading. And the only thing I can think of is the fact that they felt like family. Well, as we've had discussions on this pod before, I've heard them about, you know, the X-Men felt like family rather than team.
I mean, are you particularly kind of drawn to that Claremont era of X-Men? Like, is that kind of the era that hooked you then?
I think so. You can tell how old somebody is in Britain by which Doctor Who is their doctor. And mine's John Pertwee. And I think you can tell an X-Men fan how old they are by which era of the X-Men they came across first. And of course, when I started, the first comics I picked up were black and white reprints by Marvel UK. And that started with, I think, the pre-All New, All Different. I think it went through the 60s X-Men and then started on All New, All Different. So the first one I read was probably a black and white reprint about 98, 99, 100. I was buying them from a sex shop in Manchester. It's a long story. The owner got thrown into prison. The comic shop was a front for the sex shop. And I was the only woman that ever went in there. I think I was the only woman they had ever seen that was actually human and not printed on paper and glossy. I'm not joking. And there was a curtain, and behind the curtain was a sex shop. And I was buying these black and white reprints. I was buying them because Captain Britain was the main stories. And so this would be the Alan Moore, Alan Davis and Delano Captain Britains. So when Excalibur sort of like was going back to my obsession with Alan Davis and Captain Britain as much as my love for Kitty and Kurt, things are circular.
That was going to be my next question. So when Excalibur came out, was it something that you were kind of anticipating and looking forward to? And if so, did it live up to your hopes and dreams?
I would follow Alan Davis into hell. I've been following him since DR and Quinch in 2000 AD through Captain Britain, Marvel Man. Wherever he went, I followed. So, no, there was absolutely no doubt that I would be buying Excalibur.
Did you buy the title kind of throughout its run, or was it just kind of the Davis issues that you stuck with?
I think I gave up when Alan Davis left writing his. I think that's about when I gave up. I'd have to go through the boxes upstairs to find out, but that feels about when I gave up on it. So yeah, I bought The Sword Is Drawn. I bought two copies of The Sword Is Drawn, and I was completely disgusted by how bad the pagination was on the printing, because that's the sort of thing I noticed. But it was just beautiful, and it was just fantastic, and I loved it from day one.
What's your kind of reaction to Excalibur as a UK reader? Like, we've talked on the pod before about its representations of the UK, and, you know, obviously two of us are Canadian, one of us is American, so we just don't have that context personally. Did you feel that it was a satire, that it was an accurate representation of British culture? What was kind of your feeling about it?
Yeah, I think it was an accurate representation of the sort of pop culture Brit. You know what I mean? Alan Davis is a master of visual humour. There are so many little in-jokes. I mean, everything right from the Captain Britain days. The Crazy Gang were a 1930s radio show. You know what I mean? So even by the standards of when Captain Brit came out in the 80s, that was old and niche and an in-joke that most people reading it wouldn't know. And by 2021, it's sort of like, it's 90 years old. God, don't say that. It's, you know, it's 90 years old. That had always been the sort of thing that went on in 2000 AD and Warrior. And they carried on with that sort of humour into Captain Britain and then on from there into Excalibur.
I read an interview with Davis where he said that normally he was asked to like lay off some of that visual background humor, and Excalibur was really empowering for him because they told him to go wild with it.
And in contrast to the issue of the comic we have today, where an artist was trying to do that and missing, there was a couple of times when I really flinched because I thought, you're trying for whimsy, Sunbeam, and you're just not getting it.
Yeah, that's it. That feels about right.
But if you make it look that easy and that effortless, I'm not sure people actually appreciate how difficult it is.
I think that about writing, you know, if you read something and you almost, if the writing is transparent to you, you have no idea how much effort went into that.
It's a skill. Making something look that easy, you know, it's difficult.
Absolutely. Can I ask you a little bit about your sort of history with fandom? I mean, you mentioned being the only woman going into the sex shop. I mean, the sex shop / comic shop, pardon me. But what were your kind of experiences like sort of as a female comic book fan in the 80s? And you obviously attended a lot of conventions during that time as well. Did you find it kind of a welcoming atmosphere, or did it sometimes feel like a lonely space?
Going in the sex shop did have its advantages, because I wouldn't have discovered Bizarre Sex and Omaha the Cat Dancer if it hadn't been in a sex shop. And I had a great collection of Fat Freddy's Cat for the same reason. But it was... the past is a different country. In some ways it was lonelier, and in other ways it wasn't. There were very few girls, very few women. I used to get... Once I'd discovered that I want the X-Men, I wanted to buy the back issues. So we're up to about 1980 by now, so I've got about 5 or 6 years worth of back issues to buy. So then I started going into every comic shop in town. There was about four, and buying back issues and talking to the staff. And again, I was, even though they weren't sex shops, that I was still the only woman in there. But they were never rude. They probably didn't dare, but you know what I mean? They were nice lads. And then I fixed on one comic shop, and I would go in there on a Saturday and spend 4 hours talking with the staff. And we all did this. And this is what I meant by it was lonelier, but it wasn't, because you had to get together in person. So you'd pick up your comics. I'd made friends with the staff. I'd go sit in the back with a cup of tea and we'd talk for 4 hours about the comics. We'd read them and talk about them because there was nobody else, no other way to do it. You know, there were appers. There was an X-Men apper that I was a member of because I knew about appers from science fiction fandom because we had those. And there were sort of like fan clubs of various things, but it was so dispersed. And so Britain is about the size of a small American state, so there are only a finite number of fans and fan locations. And the comic cons were just starting to take off, but they weren't like modern ones. These were fan-run conventions, which are a completely different animal to a pro convention. Both science fiction conventions, media conventions, comic conventions, if they're run by fans for fans, are fantastic. They just push all the right buttons. And you get to meet the pros. I used to be the hostess at the comic shop in Manchester, Odyssey 7, because the owner's wife hated doing it. So they would get me in to arrange the tea and coffee and whatever the guests wanted to eat. So whenever anybody from Marvel or DC or authors, literature authors and that came in, I would be the one that would organise the food for them and the drinks and sit around. And my copy of God Loves, Man Kills has written on it by Chris Tissue, who makes a great cup of tea. And the PR people usually would tell you, Chris Claremont drinks tea, John Romita Jr. drinks Coke. You know what I mean? They'd fill you in. They want McDonald's, you know, and things like this. And so this was an evening signing session. It was John Romita Jr., I think, and it might have been Brent Anderson and Chris Claremont. And it got to 5 o'clock and all the shops shut, because this shop was down in student land and right out of town. And it occurred to me at 5 o'clock that we had no milk for Chris Claremont's tea. So I ran around like a headless chicken until the local cafe took pity on me and gave me a pint of milk. And then they swan up at 7 in the evening, do the signing. I said, would you like a cup of tea? And Chris goes, oh, I'd love a cup of tea. Can I have it black, no sugar? I had hunted high and low for the milk for this bloody cup of tea. And the bugger didn't want milk in his tea. So I think this might be why the copy of God Loves, Man Kills says to Sue, who makes a good cup of tea, because I think I might have said something.
Oh, fair enough. I mean, are there any other kind of stories about interactions with people that you've met over the years that you're interested in sharing? If not, we don't have to talk about it, but you're welcome to if you would like.
Most of the ones that shouldn't be said in public don't actually involve Chris Claremont. He was in a different tribe. The tribe I was friends with were the Alan Moore, I'm blanking on all their names, the big gang, Brian Bolland, the Warrior crew were the ones that I had, a lot with Brian Talbot. Because he lived near me, and they were my gang. And Alan Moore loathed Chris Claremont because Chris was more famous than him. And we did all know that Alan Moore was a better writer than Chris. A different sort of better. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't a knock at Chris. He was a different sort of writer and was doing things with the medium that nobody else could do. So it wasn't a case of we thought Chris, it wasn't for the fans, it wasn't a rivalry between them, but on a pro level. And Chris had no animosity towards Alan at all, absolutely not at all. But I've been out for dinner for a couple of times with Chris Claremont, because I've always had an in, because one of my writer friends is one of his exes, one of his ex-girlfriends. So it's very easy to go up to an author and go, hi, I'm friend Sue, and you've got an instant in, because he knows, you know, this is one of my ex's friends. So we've been out for dinner a few times, and I remember once he said, they're clamping down at Marvel, I'm not allowed to just randomly take strange people out for dinner, it has to be business. And I said, I like the comic, and he went, that'll do. And then he charged it to his Platinum American Express card. I didn't even have a credit card, do you know what I mean? And nobody else at the table did. You know, we were in our early 20s, we'd never even seen. I think this is the time that the guy had to go and check whether it was real, because the guy in the restaurant had never seen one either. But we had several dinners out together, and we came back from one with his ex and her current husband, and and Chris were alone in this huge hall of the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool. And the Adelphi was the place where the Titanic went from. Well, the Titanic passengers were supposed to go from. So all the public spaces are the same design as the ones on the Titanic. It was owned by the White Star Line. And so they had this hotel built. Then they eventually decided to ship them from Southampton, but the hotel was built. It's still there. It's very faded grandeur. And it has this vast, vast lounge, which we were using for the Easter science fiction convention. So there's about 1,000 people there. Chris is one of the guests. And everybody is out for dinner. And we've just come back from dinner. And there's about 4 people in the lounge. And Chris and decided to have an imaginary sword fight with imaginary swords, because there was a strict policy of no weapons. So you've got these 2 grown men, probably in their 30s or 40s, pretending to have a sword fight with sound effects, swishing sound effects like Star Wars, on all these sofas and chairs in the Adelphi Lounge. And they were having an imaginary sword fight for my imaginary honour, if I remember rightly. And Chris cheated, and a la Wizards, he drew a gun and shot who died dramatically. And I just stood there thinking, we're not with them. If we get thrown out the hotel, you know, this would be embarrassing. And yes, it was a very jolly time. Though we might have had a drink or two. It was a very jolly time. And by the time the next EasterCon came around a year later, you'd not believe how many people were in that hall, except they weren't. The story had gone round. But I know there was only about 6 people in there. But of course, everybody wants to say, oh no, I was there when and Chris Claremont were having a sword fight in the Adelphi Lounge. It was very fun. There was a lot of fun had, and a lot of booze. Not quite sure I survived the 1980s, but I'm waffling on, sorry.
No, I could talk about these stories all day. We've been kind of doing filibusters of the last few issues. probably will talk about this one a little bit today, but I'm also just happy to talk about 80s fandom.
You did ask.
Mm-hmm. Of course I did. I wanted to talk about it, but I also want to talk about kind of your fan activities and your affection for Nightcrawler, which you've already brought up, and kind of your take on that character. But I think we'll do the issue summary first, and then I'll get you to talk with us a little bit about that afterwards. So I know we've got lots of lovely listeners reading along with the pod. We love you, and we'd never not call you for a year after finding out you weren't actually dead despite having ample access to high-tech video phones. But we will kick off today's mayhem with a plot summary. Excalibur number 41 opens with civilians fleeing Neil's pub in London. Soon, we discover why. The X-Men and Excalibur have taken over the bar. For clarity, this X-Men team consists of Storm, Jean Grey, Wolverine, Psylocke, now Japanified, Colossus, and Rogue. As you'll recall, the X-Men pretended to be dead, and Excalibur believed they were dead for a very long time. Until this issue, as far as we know, because it hasn't actually come up before. Continuity-wise, they must have known, but anyway. Jean Grey seems like she's about to invite Kitty and Kurt to rejoin the X-Men, but Kitty interrupts her to say they don't want Jean's stinky team anyway, because they're too mad about the whole pretending to be dead thing. And you know what? She's got a point. Kitty storms out, but Kurt stays behind, sipping a beverage next to Logan. Meanwhile, in central London, we catch up with Di Thomas and Alistair Stewart on a street blocked by heavily armed policemen. Alistair is shocked by the show of force until Di shows him a photo, and suddenly Alistair is on board. Mysterious. Back at the pub, everyone watches nervously as Brian approaches his sister, Betsy Braddock. The group heaves a collective sigh of relief as the siblings embrace. Back in London, in a police van, a man named Phineas Umbridge is surrounded by the remains of his former gang, whose souls he has absorbed into a crystal. He plans to give them new bodies with superhuman abilities. As it passes Neil's pub, the van hits a pothole, making Phineas drop the crystal. The contained souls escape into the air. Inside the pub, Logan is chatting with Kurt when suddenly there's a scream outside. The X-Men and Excalibur rush toward the sound and find people being menaced by anthropomorphic office furniture possessed by the newly released souls. At first, the teens laugh off the threat, but are quickly forced to take it at least somewhat seriously. Amid the fight, Kurt rescues a woman who conveniently tells him about the crystal and its relationship to the souls. Kurt closes the 2 halves of the crystal to re-imprison said souls. While all of this is happening, Colossus is on the roof talking to Rachel. He's acting like more of a jerk than usual, and soon we see why. He's actually a werewolf. So are the other X-Men, who peel off their skins and attack Rachel, who they still want to take back to Mojo World. As he's wont to do, Kurt saves the day by throwing a random thing at another thing. In this case, throwing the crystal at the werewolves. He's done this like 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
It works. Merges. It does work. I mean, don't mess with it.
That's how magic works. Yeah, sure. I read Harry Potter.
So it merges or captures the souls or something. I don't really care. The important thing is the werewolves go poof. The issue ends with Excalibur finally calling the real X-Men. even though it's 3 in the morning. All right, let's start with some first impressions. Sue, you already did a bit of an opening salvo on those first impressions, but yeah, what was your reaction to revisiting this issue?
I hate you for making me read it again.
I'm sorry.
So they were trying to do a Claremont and Davis and failing. You know what I mean? It didn't feel like they were doing their own thing. The mock old English pub and barmaid. Please tell me everybody over that side of the pond doesn't think that we have just mock Tudor pubs and women in cod medieval bustier. It was bad enough it's sort of in the 70s with Banshee, and but, you know, this is 20 years after that. And oh, just don't get me started on policemen and policemen's helmets. And why is there some office furniture in the street? Wouldn't
it
street
was, like, really shoehorned in, like the pub owner's like, if I'd known there was going to be a fight in the pub, I wouldn't have taken all this office furniture and put it on the street. And it's just like, oh my God, why?
Couldn't they just have used, you know, a post box and a, you know, a street furniture that would
be very odd.
I think the only thing I did note that I have thought this ever since I first saw it, that Di Thomas is the spitting image of Gene Hunt from Life on Mars. He wears the same raincoat. Have you seen the British Life on Mars?
Oh, I haven't seen the British
one. I've seen a little bit of it, yeah.
Just astonishingly good. And the policeman in that looks like Di Thomas, sounds like Di Thomas, shouldn't be allowed a gun like Di Thomas. You know, it's quite astonishing. I think it's just a generic trench coat wearing British guy based on the Sweeney. But it is uncanny, the resemblance between the two.
Yeah, I mean that, like, sort of aping Claremont and Davis thing, I mean, that starts with the cover, right? Which is, you know, a take on Alan Davis's cover. And I mean, it even says David Hoover, like Dave Hoover after Alan Davis, right? I had a memory of liking this issue more, and then upon rereading it, not so much. And I really think that reading all of the Lobdell issues has gotten to me. But I'm anxious to hear your other first impressions.
I am very similar. I don't hate this one. I mean, I've been very hard on the last few issues. I'm trying to not be as hard on this one because it's not awful. I mean, it's not good, but it's not awful. At least that's where I'm at with it. It's like you're doing a thing. That's basically what I've got with it. It's just like no one's in character, but I can excuse it a little bit by saying, but they're not really them, so fine, I guess. This is a very much a, well, at least that's over. That's how I feel about much of the story. It's like, oh, well, we're done with that. Let us never speak of this again. Much like a lot of Lobdell's run, a lot of this requires people who should be smart, namely Kitty and Rachel, to be dumb for the purposes of allowing the story to move from page to page. I have a sister who is 13 years younger than me. My parents are a half sister. My parents were divorced when I grew up. They got divorced when I was a year old. So I didn't grow up with my sister. I grew up with my brothers, my mom's other children. So I don't see my sister often. We didn't grow up together. You know, I might go several years between seeing my sister, but I recognize her when I see her. And if some other random person were to be like, "Hi, Mav, it's me, your sister, Jackie," and it weren't her, I would know.
Yeah.
I would know who my sister is. Like that. I'm fairly certain. My sister's never changed race. But even then, I just feel like I recognize her relatively well. So things like that just require Kitty to be stupid and even Brian to be stupider than he should be. Like, the logic just is why.
Yeah, it's the Promethean exchange thing all over again. For me, two terrible things. I hate that this is the reunion and they decide to depict the fake one and leave the real one to the reader's imagination. That's a terrible choice. And exactly in keeping with what Mav was saying, like, for me, the big complaint here is that the depiction of the women is still really out of tune. The male characters are presented as confident, they're assertive, they're assured, and the female characters pout and fuss and need to be mansplained to all the time. And it's really frustrating, especially for Rachel, who continues to be in her, like, sexy, sad, helpless phase. And like, that scene with Colossus is a really good example of it. That's not who Peter is. He's not someone who could explain things to Rachel like that. And Rachel's not someone who could have that kind of revelation come from him, I would argue. So there's just a whole lot happening here that is like I agree with Mav as well. Like, this isn't the worst Lobdell issue. I think it's maybe even one of the better ones. Yeah. But it's still way out of tune, I guess, is really just the only way to describe it. It's not the same stories. It's not the same characters.
Why did Rachel forget she was a telepath?
Yeah,
which seems like
why does she not know this?
It's I think the thing that frustrates me, both art and writing, is that you're a professional, for heaven's sake. You know, you are paid to do this. This is can you not, as a professional, turn in a bog standard filler issue? And he hasn't managed it for how many months? You know, it's like,
yeah, no. We're a few in at this point.
Yeah, it's, I can perhaps your first one or two, I could understand teething troubles.
Yeah,
but particularly Rachel, it's like you've been writing her for 7 issues. Have you not twigged yet? Yeah, you know, has the penny not dropped? Or have you not decided what this character is apart from? Oh, I don't know. Just don't get me started.
Yeah, and it's not even regressive. It's not like he's forgotten Rachel's progress. It's Rachel was never the character that we see in this issue, in my eyes. It's just it's like a new character Lobdell has made up, wearing Rachel's skin, ironically, in a story with that very literal premise from the villain's perspective.
That completely breaks the premise of the werewolves as well, because they have an entire page of Di explaining how they've made their own costumes to look
and
like
Wolverine it. Claws.
Yes, and that's not werewolf's work. And that might explain, could you just see a werewolf sat at a sewing machine? Just, you know, but how did they do the skin? You know, it just, yeah, no, sorry.
I have a question for the group. I mean, obviously none of us love this, but I was just thinking about what Andrew just said about like, this is never who Rachel was. And one problem with this is now, okay, this is qualified. I understand that Andrew's livelihood is based on you being a Claremont scholar, right? Like that's so like clearly you're going to have a preference there, but
I've literally never made a dime off the Claremont run.
Good point.
My mental well-being.
Well, more your, not, I mean, not your, I wasn't thinking about money so much as it's your most well-known scholarship. Is that
sure,
fair?
Yeah.
Okay. So clearly you're going to be a Claremont fan, but I'm wondering, can we be fair to Lobdell if he were going to be the writer of record for longer than, I think there's, I didn't count, but I think we had 9 issues of him, something like that. Like if he were the new guy, we'd want him to have the leeway to not be beholden to Chris's stories, right? Like if Lobdell were starting a 10-year run on Excalibur, he's gonna have his own take on characters, and I don't have to like his Rachel, but he's allowed to have a different Rachel than Claremont had. But for me, my problem with Rachel particularly is I don't know what he's going for. Like, it's not just that like she's boring to me, it's that I don't know what you're doing, as opposed to his take on Kitty, who I also don't like. But Lobdell sees Kitty as a spoiled brat, and he writes her consistently as a spoiled brat, who's a spoiled brat I don't recognize. Rachel is a sometimes vapid and sometimes powerful, and sometimes just kind of there. Like I said, she forgot she had telepathy. You know, any other time, Rachel can barely keep thoughts out of her head. And yet here, she is unable to notice that Peter, this person that she knows well, is trying to gaslight her. She doesn't notice that she can't pick up psychic overload from Betsy and Jean. She doesn't have questions of, gee, why won't Jean love me? Which is literally her defining characteristic for the last 15 years. So she just seems weird.
If Lobdell, God forbid, was the new regular writer, I get that. You cannot be Chris. You should do, you know, plough your own furrow.
Right.
But you would at least have a clue about how the characters have been written previously to base your version of them on. And I think that is the problem with Rachel, particularly Rachel interacting, as you say, with Jean. It's just such a red flag to anyone who knows anything about either character. You know, it's awful.
I've done a lot of thinking about kind of Lobdell's Rachel and just where it's coming from. And it's hard not to just go to the well of misogyny with it, because it just really reads like someone who doesn't have the knowledge to write a powerful woman convincingly and doesn't have the belief that this type of woman could exist. And it's just depressing to read, because, I mean, I get that thing of you can have your take on characters, but I think as readers, we're also allowed to be offended by that take of characters.
Absolutely.
I'm allowed to find this take on Rachel misogynist the same way I'm allowed to, like, you know, doing anti-sex priest Nightcrawler is a take. I'm allowed to find that offensive, and, like, I'm not writing it, so it's not my choice, but at the same time, like, I'm allowed to have feelings about it.
Well, and I think maybe that's a good example, because understanding your feelings on anti-sex priest Nightcrawler, as you call him, right? You at least understand why that decision was made. You don't recognize him as the character that you want him to be, but like, you can describe things about that character. I don't know that I can describe what's happening with Rachel here. Like, I just,
I literally don't know what to even say sometimes. And but that's weird.
Actually a good comparison, because to me like both of those choices are coming from a realm of tropes and stereotypes and applying that to characters rather than sort of doing something different organically from what had existed with the character.
I'm an artist, so I looked at this, and the thing that offended me almost more than the writing was the art. Imagine I'm saying this about the writing, not the art, because I am much more versed in the language of art, and I look at the art and I think, you are one of those artists who can only draw superheroes. You can't draw superheroes in normal clothing. There's Megan and Brian at the end sat in the lighthouse relaxing in their superhero clothes. You can't draw people in space. Curtis hovering, not sitting, and the same with Brian and Megan. You know, the people do not exist in a real space because all you can draw is superheroes. And translate this into the writing. Do you know what I mean? Lobdell is doing the same thing. All he can write is a certain sort of stereotype superhero story. He cannot put that in space. He can only draw, the artist can only draw one sort of woman's face and shape. The writer can only write one sort of, you know, do you see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that is Lobdell's problem. And I think that's the problem with the art as well. And it's the nuance and the subtlety that means that Alan Davis has 5 different shapes for men's bodies and at least 4 different shapes for women's bodies. This artist has 1 shape for men's bodies and 1 shape for women's bodies. The writer has 1 shape for male superheroes and 1 shape for female superheroes. Do you see what I mean?
I think that's accurate. I think that's extremely accurate.
And a number of kind of the racial issues we've had lately, some of them have been different artists, but just the extreme fetishization of her body has been a lot. And, you know, I mean, Davis fetishizes her too, but it's extreme here. It's just sort of like every pose. And when you apply that kind of pose to a scene in which she's supposed to be thoughtful, in which she's supposed to be having complex emotions, that's when we talk about objectification becoming a distraction, because it's taking away what the meaning of the scene should be by distracting us with her fetishistic presentation so that we actually have trouble listening to her words. Like, that's just a textbook example of that to me.
No, that's it is. You're quite right. Particularly the panels where it was her and Peter and these, you know, large panels of her done like fetish paintings, you know, or photograph for no good reason.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, people who listen to this podcast know we're into sexiness in comics, but there is such a thing as sort of tone and pacing and sort of picking your spots, and some instances of sexiness are more effective than others.
For me, it's that if you do it, you know, in The Incredibles, when, you know, if everybody is super, nobody is? I think that's what's happening here, right? If Rachel is sexy all the time, then who cares about why, you know, when she's supposed to be sexy? And I think that's some of what's happening here, right? She's sitting there at the very end of this book, just sort of leaning, talking, you know, around the lighthouse, looking like super hot and super thirsty. And like she's supposed to just sort of wistfully be wondering about her place in this plane of existence, even. And yet she looks, you know, super hot. Kitty, right, is just like in Playboy phase when she's trying to decide whether to make a phone call on the next to last page. There is no turning off. I think part of this is intentional. If anybody's ever read How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, it was Marvel's essentially art guide for, you know, for kids like me in the early 80s. But like basically how to draw comics in the Marvel House style by Stan Lee and John Buscema. And it's very much a trying to be dynamic at all times, because it's not teaching you to draw, it's teaching you to draw superhero comics exactly like Sue just said, and it feels like that's happening here.
There's a reason why I like Zot and Mage and Love and Rockets and ElfQuest and 1001 other comics over superhero comics.
People should read Zot, by the way. You've mentioned it like 3 times. I just want to, if our listeners haven't read Zot, it is brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. It's written by Scott McCloud, who probably best known for writing Understanding Comics, but it is amazing.
It's a comic with heart. You know, I like comics with heart. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. But anyway, sorry.
Yes.
No, I want to talk about a couple of other things, but I did just have to point out that I was particularly bothered by that introspective page with Rachel at the end, in which specifically the pose that she's doing as she's leaning on the railing is that she is angled for penetration. It is like an explicitly that's what's happening pose. Spines. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's what we mean when we're talking about distracting sexiness that is perhaps not additive to the particular moment that we're doing there.
I was just saying, remember that scene with Megan in the negligee, angsting over Brian, lusting over Courtney, I think it was, when she's got her arm behind her back and she's got her finger in her mouth and she looks like a 12-year-old. But that that was sexiness for a reason. She is his malleable, vulnerable girlfriend. Do you know what I mean? And that was done completely deliberately rather than just for cheesecake. It was part of the character that he was.
Absolutely. That's like a really good example of like, you know, doing sexiness in a way that's additive to the story rather than distracting, right? Yeah.
Well, and Megan's sexuality defines her, Megan's explicit sexuality and childlike sexuality defines her in a way that Rachel's doesn't, which is not to say Rachel's not sexy. She is, but it has always been a different kind of thing, right? Rachel has androgyny, not, you know, cheesecakiness. I think that an artist should have the right to change things, but there could be deliberateness to it, and there's not here. This is just how it's drawn, because
it's poor art and poor writing rather than by design.
Let's change gears to talk about something a little bit more fun, which is that I do want to talk about your long fandom of Nightcrawler, Sue, because obviously I'm familiar with your fan art involving Nightcrawler and involving other characters like Logan as well. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your particular affection for that character, something we obviously like doing on this podcast from time to time. Because one of the things that particularly interests me about kind of your Nightcrawler art is that there's often kind of a gender fluid or feminine quality to some of your Nightcrawler art that I find very interesting. And you can say whether that's fair or not, but I mean, I'd love to hear about sort of the source of your affection for this particular character and what draws you to him.
All I can say is, oh God, he's macho by comparison to most of my drawing.
Fair enough.
Manga and Shonen Eye before some of you were born, you know. One of my friends is a very well-known scholar in manga fandom. She's interviewed various authors and written books about them, and she is an absolute world expert. And she used to go to Japan. She used to get shipped to Japan by her publisher to talk to Miyazaki, people like this. And she would buy me porn at the airport in their equivalent of Warsaw, or you know, and she would bring me home through customs these vast telephone books. And she said she was standing there buying explicit male porn with beautiful young men, stood next to a little old lady buying a knitting magazine, and a little Japanese lady buying a knitting magazine, and this blew her mind. So yeah, a lot of my fan art of men is very pretty. I like A Distant Soil. I like Rose of Versailles. I like a lot of very pretty men. So Kurt is positively macho by comparison to some of my art. But I think that canon Kurt is not as fey as fandom likes him to be. And I don't think that's a fault of fandom or canon, to be obvious. I'm a very firm believer that whatever fans enjoy about whatever character is up to them. I don't like people to gatekeep their fandom. Everybody's view is pretty much valid. There are some exceptions, but you know what I mean? If that's what makes you happy, go with it. I got back into X-Men fandom in 2018. I pretty much stopped reading the X-Men when Chris left the first time and moved on to other fandoms and life and jobs and all this. And 2019, I was recovering from treatment for cancer and I was at home and I was bored and realised that I could look at buy comics digitally rather than floppies, which I've got thousands of upstairs. And I think the first comic that I looked at involved Kurt and Logan throwing themselves into the sun while declaring their undying love for each other.
Yep.
And I thought, good God, I've been shipping these two since 1980. It's good. I'm glad to know that it's still going on. And dived headlong back into the fandom. And I started writing more than drawing the fanfics that had been sitting in my brain for 40 years. I actually got down on paper, or electronic paper, for the first time. And I was at the Worldcon in Dublin, which is the World Science Fiction Convention, with a lot of fans there, recovering from cancer, so I had no energy. And I missed a lot of the convention because I had to keep going back to the room to sleep. And I could still type. So I was churning out a couple of stories a week of stuff that I wanted to read. And I think that's the thing with fans. I think fans should write and draw and vid and whatever what they want. And I don't ever come across Jenkins and Textual Poachers, which is a study on Star Trek, mostly on media fandom, and why women in particular write male-male homosexual slash between two characters who don't necessarily have a connection in the media that they're writing about. And as soon as you say that, as any academic, you can sort of feel their ears prick up because it is a very interesting subject. Having read Shonen Ai and Japanese stuff, Shonen Ai and slash is completely different from porn written, male-male porn written for guys, for queer guys. Yes. Queer guys can enjoy slash and are willing to write slash, and I welcome them. But in general, the women writing it are writing it for themselves and their female friends. It's exclusive, they don't let anybody read it. But that's where it sort of came from. And I say, Jenkins wrote a book called Textual Poachers, which is superb. It is very much pre-internet. He's talking to women via letters about, and most of them are Trek and media fans from the 70s, and it's fascinating. And if you'd like to borrow my copy, have at it.
We're familiar, but some of our listeners might not be.
It's a very, very interesting book if you have any interest in fandom. It is completely out of date now, you know, because fandom has moved on and changed. And I got a lovely shock when I sort of like, because what started me on Curtin Logan was X-Men 140, when they fight the Wendigo. I think that's 140.
Yeah.
And they fight the Wendigo, and then they spend two nights or three nights alone in a tent on a vacation by any other name, heading back from the Canadian Rockies down to Westchester. And I remember at the tender age of 19 or 20 thinking, what are they doing in that tent? And it was like, I know what they're doing in that tent. And it's gone on since then. When I told a friend of mine last year that I'd gone back to writing my first slash fandom, he rolled his eyes and said, oh my God, it's that fucking tale. And I went, yes, it certainly is, darling. This has been going on that long. But when I started in 1980, we did talk about it, but it was like you would get together at a fanish gathering and we'd eventually start talking about slash, and I'd go, well, I like Curtin Logan. Everybody would go, who? Or if they did know who they were, we'd have a nice conversation. But none of the media, at media conventions, none of the zine dealers who had racks of Kirk Spock and professionals and Blake Seven slash
Napoleon and Ilya.
Oh, thousands of them. and no comics at all. No, you know, no Batman, Superman, nothing. You know, comics, there was just not any. So I got a pleasant surprise in 2019 when I went online and found that AO3 had plenty, but it didn't have enough, so I started doing my own, like you do. Because that's part of fandom. Fandoms are creative. We say this a lot in science fiction fandom, that fans, even if they go to a science fiction convention, these are fan-run ones. Even if they're in the audience, they shouldn't be passive. They should be part of it. So they've got three people sat at the front talking, three authors. But the interaction between them and their fans is a two-way street that we've all missed during lockdown. And fans make quilts and knit and cosplay and write fanzines and have fan wars. You know what I mean? They are not passive consumers. They consume, but they also add to the media that they consume. And I think that's brilliant. And I've seen it in other places because the people that do reenactment are the same, cut from the same cloth. Civil War reenactors, English Civil War reenactors, and medieval reenactors are doing the same thing. In Britain, it always involves beer, because if it's a science fiction, it involves a bar, and if it's a medieval thing, it involves a tent or a pub. But social lubricants. Fans create, fans add to their fandom rather than just passively consuming, in my experience.
Yeah, and I mean, academically, that's a way that we often define fandom, although there are a bunch of subterms in academia, transformative fandom and passive fandom and all these different things that we talk about. And, you know, fanfic and sort of fan activities like that are usually classified under transformative fandoms. But I don't know. I'd love to talk just a little bit more about the sort of connection between Kurt and Logan. And I know Andrew in particular is going to have thoughts about this as well, but sort of having to do with the ways that we can read both characters as queer characters. And I'll say for my part, I have written Kurt Logan slash fiction before. I kind of got out of doing it in part because of feelings I had about the character of Wolverine and sort of how violent he has become, and I just don't enjoy it anymore. And it became a problem for me writing that ship because Kurt has to be so ignorant and forgiving all the time, and it just got uncomfortable for me. But in terms of like situating it within the Claremont era where they had that certain kind of relationship, and then, you know, obviously moments like that House of X, Powers of X scene, you know, just beautiful.
I only like Wolverine in conjunction with Kurt, Aurora, and Kitty, probably, and possibly Jean. You know what I mean? I have a really small circle of people I find Logan even vaguely interesting with.
That's a valid take.
Yeah, it's but that's me, not the but I don't know. I'm actually more interested in their friendship than their sex life. I've written about 100, maybe more, stories, varying from absolute and total innocent fluff and adventure stories and stories that don't involve sex at all to completely hardcore porn. But the catnip for me with Kurt and Logan is their friendship, is the Mr. Sunshine with Mr. Grumpy, you know what I mean? The fact that Kurt can love the unlovable and Logan's pretty damn unlovable. and that, I think, is what makes... Plus the fact that they've always felt like real friends. I used to love those two and Peter going out and rolling your eyes and thinking, oh, God, don't let the three of them out without an adult. You know, how many pubs can they demolish? You know, how much trouble can they get in? And it always felt a bit like an actual real friendship between two very different people.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of physical appeal between those two characters too, in the sense that, I mean, one of my fanon head things with both of them is just Kurt's animalistic characteristics and Logan's animalistic senses, and that's a very combustible combination for a lot of interesting sexual situations.
They both know, also, they on a friendship level, they both know what it's like to be considered animals, you know, to be considered less than human. You know, they both have, in different ways, been looked at by Joe Public as creatures rather than people. I keep making a point in my fanfic that his friends do not make comparisons between Kurt and a panther or a cat, even though at times he really reminds them of one, because it's othering him, it's making him a thing rather than a person. And while if a stranger does that, he can shrug it off. If it's a friend, it might be a little more sensitive.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really enjoyed about writing Kurt Logan slash fic, and it gets back to what you were bringing up earlier, Sue, about kind of the appeal that writing sort of male-male relationships for, you know, women can have, is just the freedom to kind of experience Logan's maleness in relation to Kurt is very exciting. And I mean, in terms of the sensual experience that Logan would have enjoying Kurt, I mean, Kurt has a tail, Kurt has fur, and those things I already consider sensual in terms of Kurt's experience, which I also enjoy experiencing when I write sort of from his perspective in a story. But also just, I loved writing Logan in terms of how he thinks about the smell of Kurt and the sensual
feel of Kurt. Yeah, me too. I'm not...
Sensuality is just like intoxicating.
I'm not into fur, but I think Logan is, you know, but I have a very strong suspicion that they turn Logan on. I have had fans say, the sad thing is they think that Logan's bisexual and Kurt isn't, so he's going to be chasing that tail forever. It's quite, you know, but I'm hoping that in that tent in the Canadian Rockies, they nailed the tail. You know what I mean? I do hope so. But as I said, even if they have nothing sexual between them, I think it's a very healthy relationship for Logan, the way Aurora is. You know, neither Aurora nor Kurt are afraid of Logan or awed by Logan or under his spell the way I think some of the other characters are. You know what I mean? They just treat him as him. He doesn't wind them up the way he winds up poor Scott. He doesn't worship them the way he worships Jean. He's just their friend who is difficult and must be very difficult to be friends with. But then, as I say, then they're not impressed by him. You know, it's like,
yeah,
particularly Aurora, you could just imagine she takes no shit from him at all.
They're definitely my preferred ideal X-Men threesome.
I just think they're stable and supportive of each other. You know, the three of them would be a much more interesting and believable trio than some.
Yes, I would agree. But Andrew, I wanted to hear your thoughts about it because, I mean, I said at the top of the pod that, and you don't necessarily have to talk about the slash fic aspect, but just like the relationship between Kurt and Logan, because, you know, I said that your thread about their friendship is one of the things that got me reading again. And it really was. I was just so moved by that and thinking about how much that relationship used to mean to me. And I mean, it can still really get me. I mean, the Hawksbox scene gets me. And I read that Jonathan Hickman, Declan Shalvey, Infinite comic this week where there's this panel where Logan gets, you know, Kurt out of a stasis tube and Shelby draws him with actual heart eyes and says, aren't you a sight for sore eyes? And I was just like, oh boy, because it is deep, deep in my fan. And regardless of like whether you read there being something romantic between those characters, that Logan is 100% Kurt's biggest fan. He loves that guy. Like he just, there are so many panels you can point to where it's just Logan looking at Kurt with total admiration. Anyway, Mab, yeah, you were going to say.
Yeah, before Andrew answers, you've said either way you read it. In your headcanon, Anna, how do you read it? Do you think of them as having, I mean, requited or not, you might change your mind, but do you think of them as being a romantic component at all? Or do you read it as purely platonic? Because I don't think it matters, but I think it's hard to say that that relationship isn't there one way or the other. But how are you reading it personally?
I won't say that I, like, there have been times where I've been reading X-Men comics where I really did have it firmly in my head canon that they at least sometimes have sex.
Okay.
But there are other times where I've backed off on that a little bit more. I hate saying this because I don't want to shut down queer readings of Kurt, but I think I read it a little bit more like Logan is in love with Kurt and Kurt's not sexually in love with Logan in the same way, because I actually read Logan as a little bit more queer than Kurt, at least in terms of what we're offered in canon. But again, that's not me trying to shut down queer readings of Kurt. I love reading him as a queer and gender fluid character and stuff, but in terms of extrapolating something from canon that I think is defensible, that would be my take, if that makes sense.
That's why I asked the way I asked. I think that headcanon is important, right? We're going to have different readings. I share it with you. While I appreciate people's view of Kurt as queer, I see Kurt as very much straighter than I see Logan. But that's just my reading of it, and you don't have to share mine, you know. So that's why I wanted to ask before Andrew broke down sort of the analytic version of it, because I didn't want it to be crushed. I read the thread too. I've read the thread too, so I know what you're going to say, and yet I wanted to ask the question first. So that's why.
Anyway, go ahead, Andrew. What's your kind of take on kind of the connection between these characters?
Okay, so I'm working on something related to this for the Claremont run right now. It'll probably be out by the time this episode comes out. Just talking about how Claremont very clearly structures Logan as a character whose romantic interests are meant to represent potential life paths for himself. This isn't just in the stories, this is in Claremont's notebooks. Like, I've got a picture of it I will be posting. So, like, the simple example is Mariko versus Yukio. Yukio is sort of the freewheeling, more animal side of his personality, whereas Mariko is civilization and honor and all that kind of stuff. But that extends throughout all of, like, Logan's characterizations under Claremont. So you look at Logan then as a character who is also defined by a character arc about how he's hurt by his hypermasculinity. This has been well articulated. Scott Buchanan talks about this. It's right in his superpowers, which are basically masculinity, or extreme representations of masculinity. So I think for Logan, who, again, chooses life paths based on the way that he, like, romantically looks at different people, I think there's a very natural projection to suggest that Kurt is what he wants to be, and therefore that reads as kind of romantic automatically, because that's how Logan works. That's how he's built. And then you can look at Kurt as what Donna Haraway talks about as a promising monster, a character who exists outside of clearly defined categories and therefore is like emancipatory. So I think when Logan looks at Kurt, there's this idea of, you know, because he's already outside of society, he shows the possibility of living outside of societal strictures. And that too has the potential to read as kind of like romantic. So I think it's one of those situations where the subtext is not random. Like, there's a lot happening there that people could write essays or books about, potentially.
Much. I'm just like, oh, that's exactly so good. I mean, like, just that way that they think about each other and look at each other, and the way that, yeah, I mean, Kurt can represent that comfort in his own animalisticness that Logan strives for, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I just think forevermore that Hickman, no matter how many bits of Krakoa piss me off, they have given me a total distillation of 40 years of their relationship, however many years it is now, with that scene, the Radiant scene. Radiant with open legs, open arms, Radiant with open arms. Because you cannot deny that that is love. It might not be sexual love. It might be platonic love. You know what I mean? But that whole scene, you know, just reeks of it, drips of it. And no matter how you view that relationship, that is love. And there's so much more to love than sex.
For sure. And I mean, one of the things that I know a lot of people find very powerful about the Kurt Logan relationship is that they offer a, you know, when the relationship is positive, they offer a positive representation of men who love each other. And like, again, regardless if you rate that as sexual or platonic, that is really, really powerful in this genre that struggles so much to represent non-toxic masculinity.
Yes, because Kurt's about as far from toxic masculinity as you can possibly get most of the time.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have Kurt queued up for a second dose of charm and wit when he should have been queuing up for macho. You know what I mean? It just, that's his thing. If he wants to get you into bed, he'll charm you into bed rather than being macho at you.
Oh, I love that. Oh, I could just talk about this forever. We should talk about a couple of things from this issue. I just have like a couple of kind of questions about some of the things that this issue is doing. And one of them is sort of a question about doppelgangers, which is something we've talked about on the podcast many, many times, but comes up again here. And I wanted to ask everybody whether they did think that there was any value in this reunion with the X-Men, despite that frustration that Andrew brought up earlier about the actual reunion being deferred. I mean, do we learn anything interesting between these interactions between Excalibur and the doppelgangers of the X-Men? Because again, that's something we've talked about many times on the podcast, right? Even when it's a doppelganger character, or sometimes even especially when it's a doppelganger character, the interactions can still have value. And Kitty's reaction to the "are we going to rejoin the X-Men" thing is at least potentially interesting. And we could talk about that a little bit. But thoughts about any of that? I'll give you a first crack at it, Sue, if you want. Although I can sense Mav is keen to go.
She should go. I'm thinking how to politely do this.
No problem. So am I. I completely agree. I'm completely on Team Kitty for this, and I'm more on Team I would like to have seen the real reunion, not a fake out. Yeah. Yeah, it was too important to be a fake out.
And overdue, for sure, right? Because, I mean,
and this is the reunion, you know, this is Brian meeting Japanese Betsy for the first time, and then, we're getting it. It's not even her. Like, oh.
No.
On the other hand, like, through the doppelganger, we get a rendition of how he will react to Betsy, even though this isn't actually Betsy, right? So it's trying to have its cake and eat it too there.
Yeah. Rant at you, Anna.
Oh, no, that's okay. Feel free to rant about it. I mean, well, let's talk about the Kitty thing then. I mean, I find it very interesting that it's very Kitty, and it's very stereotypical Kitty for her to kind of be written as like the brat that Lobdell tends to write her as. But I do, again, if we're going to read this fanishly, I do find it interesting the way that Kitty is the one who storms out of the bar. Kurt doesn't follow her. He sits at the bar and watches her go. And I found that interesting. Yeah, with Logan.
That is interesting.
Right? I would say that's right. You asked me, you know, how I felt, and I said I have to compose myself. I'm going to try to do this in the generous way for a change, which is I think that if you're going to portray this reunion, I think there are important beats that should be had. And the obvious one is Kurt and Kitty especially, and then in a different way, Brian, but especially Kurt and Kitty, and especially Brian, less so Megan and Rachel, should be pissed. They have every right to be pissed about what happened. To be generous.
They tried to kill Rachel.
Yes, yeah, right. I don't mean that. Oh, Rachel has every reason to be pissed about something else. I mean about not being told that you're alive, right? Rachel has every reason to be pissed about something else. Kitty and Kurt have every right, Kitty and Kurt and Brian, you know, because, yeah, we might be hard on Brian on the show, but it is his twin sister who just let him think she was dead for a year of their time, four years for us, you know. He has every reason to be upset, and I want to see that reaction. I'm okay with Brian. I'm just so glad you're alive. I missed you, Betsy. Let me hug you. Like, that makes sense. I'm okay with Kitty storming away. I'm okay with Kurt not knowing how to handle it. So I want to see the reunion. And my problem with it is I don't know that there's a good way to handle it, because Lobdell is not Chris Claremont. And I don't know why Claremont made this decision in the first place. I said that if we go all the way back to episode one of this show or episode zero of this show, the decision the X-Men made here is stupid. It makes no sense. Nothing ever came of it. There is no reason, like there's sure sort of kind of a reason to pretend you're dead so you can strike at your enemies from the Australian outback. And maybe you want to protect your powerless friends from your enemies, so whatever. That does not apply to Kurt or Kitty. It doesn't. And it sure as hell doesn't apply to Brian. There is no reason to protect them, especially since they're going to be in harm's way anyway. And you know this, and you've had time, and like they're actively hiding from Kurt and Kitty that they're alive. And she should be pissed about it. She just should be. The New Mutants know, which we talked about in an Inferno. They know, and they don't tell her. It's cruel. The fact that Kitty, who just lost her best friend, her, you know, ex-boyfriend, but like someone she loves is alive, and the New Mutants know, and they don't tell her. And then like in the end of the story, even after you get past the werewolves, is Cable saying, oh, Excalibur, we were wondering when you were going to call. F you, phones work two ways. Like that, yeah. it doesn't work. And it's frustrating because there's a throwaway line in here where Rachel's like, why didn't I tell him? Yeah, why didn't you? And the answer is because, to be fair to Lobdell, because he wasn't writing the book and he doesn't know why they didn't call. Like Claremont made a decision to not handle this thread. And I don't know why, because literally nothing comes of it. So the entire 4 years that this has been going on just seem needlessly cruel, because next time we see them together, everything's just going to be fine. This was my one opportunity to see it addressed. And it's not really. It's addressed in a fake way. And so that, so there's a bitterness for me from it. And that's unfair to everybody involved.
I think it breaks our suspension of disbelief. You suspend your disbelief all the time. And I think this, because they're a family, the idea of them not telling their other family that they're still alive just broke it for me. And I'm sure everybody else too. You know, forget the optic blasts and the Phoenix. You break the X-Men by making them act as though they don't love each other.
Yeah, well, getting back to what Anna was saying about how, you know, like what does this accomplish? What happens on the phone call? Because Kitty tells the X-Men basically to fuck off. Does she call them and tell them to fuck off?
Well, she says then, she's not going to.
Exactly. She says so in that case, she's actually exercised that on the werewolf, right? So there is some sort of emotional transition.
But it feels cheap. So okay, here's a problem. Well, there's I'm trying to remember because I wasn't prepared to answer this, so I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and I'm not as good at this, so Andrew, you might be able to. There is a Claremont written comic when Storm finds out that Jean is alive right before Inferno. Finds out that Jean's alive. She realizes, wait a minute, if Jean's alive, hold on, I bet you Wolverine knew this. And she gets pissed at Logan for not telling her that, you know how important Jean is to me. Why, you know, how dare you keep this from me? And she damn near kills him. She drops him like from the sky because she's pissed, and she's rightly pissed at Wolverine. These are people who are volatile people, right? And that is her dealing with the fact that, you know, why wasn't I told that my friend is alive? And that is a interesting thing to see the two of those characters play out. They're literally doing this to Kurt and Kitty, and it should be hypocritical, right? Why doesn't she explain this to her? And, you know, we get this little hug scene between fake Storm and Kitty where there's not really a resolution. She's just like, oh, I'm sorry, you know, but I'm lying.
And then
I'm
makes kill the you. Evil face.
Right. So look, I want to know, how do you make up to Kitty the fact that you abandoned her? Because the anger that Kitty says she feels when she storms out of the pub, she should feel it. She's right. Yeah. She's 100% right. If my friends did that to me, I'd be pissed.
Yeah.
You do it off panel because it's lazy and easy.
Yeah.
I mean, I do just have to point out that Kurt and Logan do have a really touching reunion later in Marvel Comics Presents. Yes. I'm forgetting the issue numbers of Marvel Comics Presents, but it's right after Kurt gets his cast off. And it's an interesting setup in terms of their relationship, because Kitty asks Kurt if she can go to Germany with him. And he's like really adamant that he doesn't want her to go, and then he ends up meeting up with Logan there, and he is, for like a panel, really mad at Logan, and then they just hug and they ride a horse together, and it's very romantic, and fight monsters. And anyway, I just had to, I'll put the issue numbers of that in our on the show notes, but I feel a little bit soothed by that reaction, by that reunion that we get with Kurt and Logan later, but it does not happen actually in the pages of Excalibur.
And the reason I want to see it is, much like in this book, which is what Abdel tries to do, I want to see that Kurt has a different reaction to this than Kitty. Because Even though I think Lobdell overwrites Kitty, I've said on this show many times, my headcanon of Kitty, and I mean Kitty at this time period, obviously she's a little different in modern comics, but still kind of a problem. Kitty is an overly emotional person. You know, she can be a brat. Her intellect is through the roof, and she is not as emotionally mature as she thinks she is. And that causes her to have outbursts sometimes. And it should be hard for her to forgive. Like, not just because they did something deplorable and horrible to her, but Kitty just has outbursts like that. And she should be mad in particular at Storm, Logan, and Peter. The three of them, she should be exceptionally angry with. But Jean is here, and, you know, Jean wasn't in the Outback. Kitty barely knows Betsy. So those are parts that she shouldn't, you know, that don't. But I want to be able to compare her reaction to Kurt's. I want a scene where Kurt says, look, Catchin, you know, we have to like see it from their point of view, and her say, screw you, they have no point of view, they were angry. Like, I want to see them argue that out, and I don't get to.
A basic thing of Kurt staying behind, because that does feel very in character for him. I can see him going after her as well, but I can also see him staying behind and wanting to talk it out with the X-Men, because as much as Kitty and Kurt are friends, he was friends with them first. So they,
and he misses them. He tried to kill himself over them. He tried to kill himself over them several times. So I want to see that. I want to see the real reaction.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just that the team-ups here are strange, because it's like Rachel and Colossus and Kitty and Jean. Like, that's weird, but anyway.
Yeah, I guess Kitty and Jean don't know each other that well either, because she, you know, even... dead. Even ignoring Phoenix stuff, like whether Phoenix and Jean are the same person, the overlap is very small.
Very small. Let's do some final thoughts and start wrapping up this issue. And I'll come to you first, Andrew. I'll give Sue the last word. But anything, Andrew, that you're desperate to discuss about this issue that we have failed to discuss, or anything in the convo that we had that you want to make sure that you get in before we wrap up?
I'm in the same boat as I think most of us, just happy to be passing this hurdle before getting back into Davis. I will say that I think this arc would have worked much better if Lobdell had more time. This is a 2-issue story arc to me, maybe even a 3-issue story arc, to set up that tension. And I do think he does some good things mechanically, like introducing the furniture with souls thing. That seems silly and pointless, but it does help create a red herring where you're not just waiting for the X-Men to pounce, but then the illustrator does Storm's evil face way too soon. So yeah, and I think there were some good ideas here. I do think we are seeing Lobdell progress as a writer, but still a little rough for me.
For his last issue, he progresses? Yeah, sure.
No, well, we're going to get him back on Excalibur for a few issues, but not for a while. Mav, any final thoughts from you?
It's fine. It's over. That's kind of where I'm at. My big thing is, you know, part of the rant that I just did. And then it sort of ends with Cable, which is, have any of them ever actually met Cable at this point? I don't think so. Oh, they have?
Rachel did in Uncanny X-Men Annual.
Oh, yeah. But Rachel has known that everybody's alive for 2 years, ignoring the fact that, you know, she has psi powers. Rachel is completely aware of Jean being alive. She was around during Inferno. She should know lots of stuff. Why didn't she tell anybody?
She also kind of raised Cable, but that's not been established yet.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, where they're like, you know, why didn't I tell anybody? I don't know. And we're never going to find out, so don't worry about it. Because this is the last time that's mentioned, so.
It's basically a storytelling prompt rather than a story.
Yeah.
Rachel's thoughts are just scrambled, and you just have to go with it. Sue, if you would like the last word, anything that you're desperate to talk about this issue or anything else before we leave it in the rear view?
First time I've read this in however many years, 30-odd years, and I'll be very happy to not read it again for another.
I'll let you say if you would like to have like any thoughts about, because you're not going to be here when we do the Davis opening of the Davis arc in the next issue. Thoughts about the Davis era that we're heading into? I mean, general sense of, you know, how does it compare to kind of the Claremont era for you? And I mean, that's a huge question, and we're not going to be able to talk about it for multiple hours, which we're going to be doing. But if you have some thoughts about it, you can share them.
I think Alan is a better artist than a writer, but I think he's a better writer than some of Marvel's other writers.
That is a very succinct and fair way of putting it. Yes.
Yeah. He cut his working with some of the best in the business, like Alan Moore and Chris Claremont. And if you hang around with very, very good writers, it rubs off.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to kind of breaking down Davis's storytelling as we get into it.
Staying. There's a meeting of the Round Table.
No, I can't.
So, Sue, thank you ever so much for joining us to gush and gossip about this issue. Before we go, we need to remind our lovely listeners about what you get up to. If you would like people to find you online, where can they find you?
Well, really, the only place I'm Sue Wisterfield. You'll need to check the webpage for the spelling. But if you want to find me, I write fiction and I draw art, and it's mostly on Archive of Our Own, as Sue Wisterfield. The fiction runs from really, really mild and slightly funny stories about Kirk using the wrong shower gel to really, 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 really dirty porn. But they're mostly Kurt and Logan, but some of them aren't. Some of them are stories of early days at the mansion, because I think it must have been very interesting for an African lady and a Russian boy and a circus actor share a bathroom, you know, and things like that. the only hijinks ensuing. And I say they're all on AO3 as Sue Wisterfield, along with some of my art as well. And share and enjoy.
I would very much encourage people to check out Sue's art and fanfics, of which I have enjoyed at various times. And there's a particular story of yours that I often think about involving Kurt and Logan and Jean and telepathy and doing a lot of interesting things with sex and telepathy and experiencing sex in different bodies through telepathy, and thank you for the wonderful thought prompts.
We're expanding Jean's horizons. It's good for her.
On that note, thank you so much again, Sue, for joining us.
That's been a great fun.
Next, in 1 week's time, we'll be on to episode 43, discussing Excalibur 42, A Hatch is Plotted. Davis is back, and that's all you need to know. Except that you should also know that before we discuss Excalibur 42, we're going to be doing a holiday special episode of sorts, a holiday video episode, hopefully, in which we're going to reflect on what's almost been a year of the podcast and what I would call the first era of Excalibur. We're going to do a lot of fun stuff in that episode, including looking back on our favorite episodes and moments and revisiting some things that we weren't entirely happy with or were entirely happy with. We'll do both. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's going to be philosophical, and it's going to be video, hopefully, if we figure it out. You'll be able to see our gorgeous mugs as we talk at you. That episode will come out on Christmas Day, actually, the 25th. Our present to you, and we will launch right into the Davis era after that. In the meantime, if you liked what you heard, please follow us, like, and review the podcast wherever you're listening to it or watching it. Don't forget to check out our fabulous YouTube videos, which we've done for many of our episodes. You can find those via our website or the Vox Popcast YouTube channel. As always, if you want to chat with us about Excalibur or pitch yourself as a guest for a future episode, let us know. You can reach out via our website, goshgollywow.com, where we've got some fun extras, and via Twitter, at goshgollywow, where we post daily pages from whatever issue we're reading that week and more fun extras. Although, actually, I should stop and note, they're going to be discontinuing comments on our website through our web host, and I'm very sad about that, and I'm looking at other options to maintain the commenting function, but in the meantime, we might not have them for a while, and I'm very sorry about that, because so many of you leave us wonderful comments, but you can always still reach us on Twitter. Thank you, Andrew and Mav, for another tearful reunion. Thank you, Sue, for helping toast the good times. Thank you all for listening, and a special thanks to Maximilian of Thoughtform Music for our truly epic theme song. Play us out.
Discontinuing comments? Why?
Yeah, hi. I know. They called me to tell me. Like, they sent
like
me
on the phone?
Yeah, yeah. GoDaddy called me about it.